Welcome to the Nordic Mythology Podcast. I'm Daniel Farrand, owner of the company Horns of Odin. And before we get into the main show, which we have a really special guest for you today, I do have to do a little bit of housekeeping, and that is mainly for our Patreon. It's the way we keep the lights on, it's how we keep the podcast going, and it's how we're able to almost hit that 200 episode mark. So for £3 a month, you get a bonus episode every week where you get to ask our guest a question. You can either submit it ahead of time or you can ask it in the live chat, which is also one of the other features. You can watch all the episodes live as well as access to our Discord channel. And alongside that, another bonus episode, if you need more, we have the story time with Jonas Lorentzen, where we read through different material. At the moment, we're going through Neil Gaiman's Norse mythology from front to back, which is a lot of fun. Anybody who's listened to episodes with myself and Jonas know that we tend to have a few drinks and it's just a laugh. We have a really good time. You can get the whole back catalog and our Patreon as well. So like I say, it's just Patreon.com/ Nordic Mythology Podcast, and it really does help us. And if you can't get involved, obviously on the financial side, even just a like, share, a 5-star rating wherever you get the podcast does help. It sounds trivial, but it helps new people find the podcast. There's always people on the fringe who are wanting to get into Nordic mythology, into the Viking Age, don't really know where to start. And obviously we can get them off on the right track with some accurate information that would be beneficial, I think. But let's get into the show, because I'm super excited for this guest, and that is Anders Winroth. Anders, welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm very excited to be here.
Yeah, me too. You know, like I said, we've done close to 200 episodes, and I don't really get nervous anymore. I've been lucky enough to have some big guests and some big celebrity names as well. But today the nerves got showing a little bit. I've been listening I've been listening to your interviews watching your talks on YouTube all day in somewhat preparation.
Oof. Yeah, some of them are better than others.
Is there any that I should check out? Are any standout ones?
Well, gosh, no. There's a talk I gave in Kansas City many years ago, almost 10 years ago, which I thought came out very nice on YouTube.
That's the one that I watched.
Yeah, good. That's the one that people find, I think.
Mm-hmm. You came across very well.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. It was a great event. Funny place, Kansas City, with this amazing library they have in an old bank palace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you said it was a beautiful building.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's really remarkable.
Yeah, I would definitely recommend for people to watch that one. Rocco decided to jump on my lap, and then, you know, he does what he wants, I guess, sometimes. So we're going to look at the Christianization of Scandinavia, and the introduction of Christian law into Norway. Is that right?
Well, that's something I've been working on recently, but it's a relatively small subject compared to everything else.
I feel like nothing is a small subject when it comes to this sphere.
No, I mean I'm a professor the way I get income is that I'm a professor. So in other words, I'm paid to speak. Mm-hmm. So I do a lot of it. Don't get me started, in other words.
Well, that's what we're here to do. So hopefully, I saw you do a talk with Jackson Crawford, and I think you explained how you like to tell stories in your teaching.
Right. Yes. Yeah. No, that is the way that I think teaching works very well. Mm-hmm. You tell stories, it makes people interested, hopefully. And then one can continue.
It does. For me, my whole love of history comes from my year 11 history teacher, Mr. Ainley. So I would have been 14, and he was a fantastic storyteller.
All right.
He did a lot of his teachings through, you know, telling different stories about whatever time period we were doing. I don't think we actually did the Vikings, but I just fell in love with history because of this gentleman, and he's always stuck with me.
Right, that's great.
So yeah, I think it's a great way to teach. I think if you can do it well, it's a fantastic asset.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, so when it comes to, I guess, the Christianization of Scandinavia, is there, or is it possible to even have a starting point?
Well, yes and no, I think. I mean, one sort of has to go back to the Christianization of the Roman Empire, you know, the 4th century, the 5th century, the 6th century, and remember that, okay, Scandinavia is far away from Rome and the rest of the empire, but there's never like a wall in between. People do communicate more than we probably would instinctively think. So people learn at an early point about what's going on in the Roman Empire. They learn in Scandinavia about what's going on in the Roman Empire. And some people pick up the idea of Christianity or some ideas in Christianity or associated with Christianity. So that goes on for centuries until you start to get some more kind of concrete crystallization going on, starting kind of in the 9th century. Charlemagne, essentially.
Yeah, because I think in most people's minds, the Christianization of Scandinavia happens within the Viking Age, but I guess it sounds as though It was happening in dribs and drabs a long time before that.
I mean, it is the Viking Age when it happens. I mean, it's the Viking Age when everything happens in Scandinavia. That's when you get kingdoms and so forth, and that's when you get Christianity. Mm-hmm. But everything is sort of built up before in a slow burning way, sort of, that comes to a kind of crisis in the 9th, 10th, 11th centuries.
Mm-hmm. Is there like a main catalyst point that just sparks it? Is it like a rapid conversion, or is it a very slow burn?
Well, the I like to think about it as if that two conversions going on at the same time, or rather there is a slow process, a slow burning process of Christianization, where people pick up ideas or cultural habits and practices from Christianity. And then you get to the relatively quick process of actual conversion, which happens sort of between 820s and 1020s.
Mm-hmm. What would be the main reason for people to convert from, you know, paganism into Christianity? Is it all completely false? Because I guess the narrative that we see, or I tend to see so often online, is this fire and brimstone, very much a brutal conversion of you either convert or die, almost theatrical in a way, that you have the Vikings, quote unquote, hanging on to the end until they're forced to be Christian. I think that's the image that most lay people have.
Yeah, it's actually, I don't think that's how it really worked in Scandinavia. It's some places in Europe were converted in that way. like Germany. Charlemagne is really forcing the West Germans to become Christian in the late 8th century and early 9th. But in Scandinavia, then it's really at least it's a process that at least partially driven from inside. And this has to do with how Scandinavian society worked in the Middle Ages. I said earlier that it was really in the Viking Age that kingdoms came about in Scandinavia, and before that, like if we were to go back to say the year 800 or 700 or something, Scandinavia is sort of a political it's politically very splintered up into very small units that are not really stable countries or anything. You have essentially a lot of chieftains, petty kings all around Scandinavia who are competing with each other, occasionally collaborating with each other. It's both pull and push, as it were. And they are constantly looking for ways for new ways to become more powerful, to get more influence. And that, in a way, is a big explanation to why the Viking Age happened, why some of these chieftains started to go out and grab valuables from elsewhere. But it's also in the same way why some of them saw, okay, well, this Christianity idea seems like a good idea that I can use to make myself more powerful, bring people together under my rule.
What would be the benefits for a chieftain adopting Christianity?
Well, it's... imagine you're a chieftain who wants to become a really powerful, strong chieftain. Then you are, I think you are going to look around for models of who are the most powerful people that you have heard of. And that's going to be Charlemagne, the emperor in Western Europe. That's going to be the Byzantine emperor in Constantinople. It's going to be the kings in England. I mean, England was several kingdoms at the beginning of the Viking Age, and so forth. It's called, the most powerful people you ever heard of are all Christians.
Okay.
So this seems like there seems to be something with it. With Christianity, if you can, what many of these chieftains did was that they went out into Europe as Vikings and plundered to get gold and silver and stuff that they could bring with them home to Scandinavia, and then use this to recruit more warriors, to recruit more people who were willing to follow them, to be stronger than the chieftain in the next valley. And they figured that, if I'm able to bring Christianity back, I can say to people, come to me, and I have this really prestigious religion that I can give to you. But, the guy over there, he doesn't have anything like that. So I'm the better chieftain.
Okay, that's just got me wondering about something, because I assume that if you converted to Christianity, then being a good Christian chieftain, he probably shouldn't go a Viking and a raid in Christian monasteries, right?
Well, yes, there are many examples from history that's contrary to that.
Okay.
So, I mean, Charlemagne shouldn't be killing people left and right. He's a very good Christian and the patron of the Pope and everything, but he does it anyway.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
But it's not about being a good Christian. I mean, yes, it's there, but I don't think that's what's important at the beginning. Because what is it about religion that people notice? Well, it's what you do. Mm-hmm. It's not what you believe or what you think. Mm-hmm. So it's about behavior and the fact that, you know, Christianity is focused on a meal, the Eucharist, as is pagan religion. But the chieftains could use the meals in both religions as a way to tie their warriors closer to themselves. Mm-hmm. They had meals and banquets that didn't have any direct religious implications. They just threw great parties, and then people like them, and then people are going to be loyal to them. Mm-hmm. To me, the great party giver, rather than the guy in the next valley who can't afford to do the parties because he hasn't been out and stolen as much gold and silver as I.
Yeah, it seems like something's never changed, that popularity is always key.
Yeah, no, it is. I mean, certainly you could say in a way that these chieftains were a kind of politicians who were, it didn't work in the way it works in our modern mm-hmm. democracies, but there are similarities. They're competing. And they are trying to find tools that help them compete.
Okay.
So, and religion is one of them.
Okay. So, it's not much different than today in a sense of everybody's always looking for the one up, the next person, particularly if you're in a position of power like a chieftain, you're always looking to find another way to get better than your competitor. And it's the same, I guess, in business. You're always looking. You know, I own a business and I'm always looking at the competitors to see how I can improve. And it seems that Christianity is just another tool within that of how to get an advantage on somebody else.
Yeah, I mean, that is certainly part of what I think. I mean, it's not just a tool, but... No. Well, it seems to have been an important tool for these chieftains to build up kingdoms. Okay. The kingdoms of Denmark, Norway, and Sweden, which show up within, you know, a relatively short period of between the 960s and the 1000s. Mm-hmm. So less than 50 years, there are three kingdoms where there previously were just these chieftaincies or smaller units.
Yeah. Just before we get too far away from it, I want to pull back to something you just said as well. And it seems as though to truly understand the Christianization of Scandinavia and the Viking Age, we have to maybe look at Christianity through a different lens than maybe we do with the modern eye, because to most people today, like, it is about what you believe, it's what you think, is maybe how many times you go to church, and it's having this belief in Christianity. I guess you could be a very good Christian but not go to church. It's all about kind of personal belief. But it seems as though back in the Viking Age, it was much more based around the actions.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we must remember that individuals. I mean, of course, individuals existed, but people were not thinking of themselves as individuals in the same way in the Viking Age. It's something that came about towards the end of the Middle Ages. And I mean, the Renaissance is famous for people discovering themselves as an individual subject of stuff that was happening. Before that, people were thinking much more in sort of collective terms, that, you know, what defines me is not what I think and what I believe, but what I do together with others. It's a kind of somewhat different point of view from what we have today. Mm-hmm. And people worried about the contents of their Christianity, but beyond some quite basic and unnegotiable points, people didn't really worry about, you know, what do you think exactly about the relationship between God the Father and Jesus and these things that occupied the theologians already in the Middle Ages, mm-hmm. and still today.
I mean, I'm not the biggest fan of Christianity in general, I guess. It's always felt as though you can pick and choose the certain bits, as long as you're pick and choosing the right bits to please the right people at the right time, I guess.
I'm sure that's right. It's also, I mean, think of the title of this podcast. I mean, it's Nordic mythology. Mm-hmm. And I think, doesn't that already recognize that something that I think is very true, and that is that religion is much more important when you go back in time, and mm-hmm. certainly in the Middle Ages, than it tends to be today.
Okay, yeah.
I mean, my students, you know, I teach medieval history from like 500 to 1500, just general. And my students are often surprised at how much I talk about what's happening in the church during this time period. And that is because it's simply one of the most important factors of society at the time.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it still is today, whether...
It still is, but not in the same way.
No, but we still, maybe not as much with Christianity, but we still see, I mean, we only have to look towards the Middle East at the minute to see the religion still plays such a huge part on,
yes,
on no, the
that's,
world.
That's absolutely true.
So, okay, so I guess if we have chieftains who are converting for, I guess, personal gain and for power, how does that then trickle down into the everyday person? Was it a complete top-down sort of conversion? You would have your hierarchy converting. Would they just enforce it with iron fist, or would there be benefits for the everyday person?
Iron fist works only so far. Mm-hmm. They mostly went about it in rather clever ways. And I mean, we have to remember that this is Viking Age Scandinavia is a society that doesn't really have states with the apparatus of state. So a chieftain can't be that iron fisted, as it were. He really has to persuade people, mm-hmm. to join him, as it were.
Yeah.
And we know a great deal about how that happened in the Viking Age. I mean, you can look at, if you've ever been to a museum in Scandinavia where they have, where they display the contents of Viking Age graves that have been excavated. Mm-hmm. You've seen that there's a lot of really beautiful things made out of precious metals, like arm rings. Most of the ones you see are in silver, but there are enough in gold. Mm-hmm. The arm rings were a kind of the currency of chieftains rewarding the loyalty of their followers. I mean, to the degree that early Germanic word for king or leader translates to the ring giver.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You see that in like Beowulf or in other poetry.
Mm-hmm.
So what we should imagine is like, okay, you have these chieftains who are, they're organizing parties in the middle of the winter. I mean, for what for us is Christmas, and for before Christianity is the midwinter. It's mm-hmm. practically the same date, where the chieftain's followers come and have a great time, and the chieftain's giving out rewards like mm-hmm. these rings, and he can give out Christianity.
Okay.
Because Christianity has one feature compared to pagan Scandinavian religion that can serve chieftains very well. And that is that you have to have a priest to administer that religion. While as far as we know, the pagan religion, like anybody could do it.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's important that you have a priest, somebody who has been consecrated in a ritual, and that he does what he's doing in a building that has been consecrated, a church, and that's the only way it works. Okay. Then you can actually, as a chieftain, you can kind of monopolize this.
Mm-hmm.
Like, okay, I have this Christianity. The guy in the next valley cannot do it because he doesn't have a priest.
Okay.
And thus, I can give this to you, and that will be good to you. You're going to get arm rings as well. It's going to be good for you, I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Then people are, I think, likely to want to join this chieftain. And if they are warriors, they are likely to want to fight for him as well, when he, for instance, wants to go out on a Viking raid. Mm. And we can see this. There is a runestone here in Norway. I live in Norway right now. I'm not Norwegian, though. I'm Swedish.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a runestone where it says that I, Eivind, raised this runestone, and I built the church here that is just next to it. And I am the godson of St. Olav. So Eivind is telling us that, look, I have this great connection with the, you know, the now dead king, who's now a saint.
Mm-hmm.
He gave me this religion that I embrace. And look, now I have built a church here. And you can come to my church and be part of my entourage. And then you have an indirect link to St. Olav, because he's my godfather.
Is the church still there?
It's still there. I mean, you know, much rebuilt, of mm-hmm. course, through the centuries. I mean, it's not at all the same church, but there's a church in the same place. And the runestone is still there. That's the same, standing just outside it.
A little bit off topic. Is St. Olaf's church, is that the one that they're trying to find in Trondheim?
Oh, I mean,
am I
St. Olaf's church? I mean, there are many churches that are called the Church of St. Olaf because it's a very popular saint. But I mean, one is looking for the early churches in Trondheim and other places.
Yeah, I visited Trondheim, and I remember visiting a place that they thought was the first church.
Or the earlier church, yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's right. I don't know Trondheim very, very well. But, you know, he was, in the Middle Ages, St. Olav was buried inside the church of, I mean, he was a saint. So he was buried close to the high altar, maybe even inside the high altar of the cathedral in Trondheim. Okay. And there is a piece of a skeleton that actually the Catholic cathedral in Oslo possesses.
Oh, okay.
And a little part of it, actually, was a friend of mine who was was instrumental in getting this done. They somehow managed to get a piece of it to check with the scientific methods, and they were able to figure out that this bone is from about a man between 30 and 40 years old who died pretty much 1,000 years ago. So it actually fits. I mean, if it isn't St. Olaf or Olaf Haraldsson, it's somebody who was a contemporary of him and of about the same age, which is fascinating that you can have that kind of continuity.
That reminds me of, I recently, within the last year, visited Durham Cathedral. And I don't know if you've ever been, but in the basement there, I think it used to be the kitchen, actually, is where they've converted to keep St. Cuthbert's.
Yes.
I don't know if the skeleton's still there, but certainly his coffin.
Yeah.
Is there. I can't remember if the
skeleton should be there.
I'm sure it probably is.
And bead as well in Durham.
Yeah. So that's a similar thing. And that was deemed so important. Am I right in thinking that they took St. Cuthbert from Lindisfarne when the raids happened, and they took the body?
Yes. I mean, he was already dead when the Vikings showed up in Lindisfarne. He should have been in Lindisfarne at that point. And yes, they did move his skeleton to his relics. Mm-hmm. This is Catholic religion and medieval religion, that the bodily remains of a saint are very important. And like the greatest treasure of any church. And they moved him. There's actually a medieval little text about it. They moved him first to a place called Chesterley Street.
Okay.
Which is, as I said in the beginning, I used to live in Newcastle, so I actually know where that is. It's south of Newcastle, but it's today a small place, but then it was a central location. Mm-hmm. And then when it became less of a central location, they moved his body to Durham.
Yeah.
And this is very typical of what happens with saints in the Middle Ages and even today.
Mm-hmm. It just shows that importance, though, doesn't it? How they left the gold and silver, but you have to take the relics.
Yeah. There's a story of, when you talk about the conversion of Scandinavia, you often talk about this monk whose name was Ansgar, who had headquarters in Hamburg, and he was a missionary and working on Scandinavia. What you generally hear about him, half of it are lies that he himself and his successor made up, as actually a student of mine was able to prove a few years ago. But what's interesting about Ansgar from this context is that he was in Hamburg, and Hamburg was attacked by Vikings in 845.
Okay.
And because there is a medieval biography of Ansgar, we know that he got away with his life. And the two things he thought of bringing with him was, he put on his cape so he wouldn't freeze, and the relics.
Okay.
That was all he got with him when he ran away from Vikings in 845 in Hamburg.
Well, that's all he needed.
Yeah, that's to him, this was the most valuable possessions of his missionary station.
Of course. Okay, to pull it back onto topic.
Yes.
It seems as though the Christianization was based quite heavily on gift giving or reward, on that kind of that idea. So do you think that people then genuinely did convert and believe in, you know, the one true God? Or do you think it was more of like a plastic conversion to get the gains, but then deep down they were still pagan at heart? Because I guess it's tough to just cast your beliefs away.
Must also consider that belief is not that important at this time. This is before the church is starting to look for heretics and people who have the wrong beliefs, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that, you know, I think it goes back to what I said, that you have this conversion process. This is quite rapid in the 9th, 10th, into the 11th century. And then you have this Christianization process. It starts much earlier and continues much later, much after the actual conversion. And I think that goes to your question that people don't cast off all their habits of thought and habits of what they do immediately. That takes time, if it ever happens.
Yeah.
So what it is about, I mean, if you would have posed this question to somebody who lived in, say, the year 1000, he or she would surely say that, well, you know, I used to sacrifice, be part of these big parties where we killed a goat and ate it, and, you know, gave the blood to the pagan gods. But now I go to church,
mm-hmm.
you know, when I can be bothered, or when I have an errand in that direction. There were not a lot of churches initially, obviously. Mm-hmm. And I think that would have been much more, that would have signaled to him what is, you know, that he's Christian now instead of pagan believer. And you can see that the kings and others, this was what they pay attention to as well, because they are really outlawing for people. You know, they say, I will come and get you if you sacrifice to the pagan gods, or if you do these things that are not Christian. This is laws also many centuries after the actual conversion. The laws don't say you have to believe in X theology or so forth.
Yeah,
it's really about what you are doing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I guess it. We all look for neat little boxes to put things in, and I guess that we. It's easier to just think of, oh, it converted in the year 1000. Whereas I assume it's a much more gradual process and probably like incremental small changes from generation to generation. Probably how a lot of people have seen, maybe even in their own life, with how society has become more progressive in recent times. We all probably have grandparents who have very strong opinions in one way or another, and then it's kind of, I can certainly see it in my family. You know, my grandparents had, without being specific, my grandparents probably had certain opinions on certain people, and then you see that then passed down to like my parents. They maybe hold some of it, but not all of it, not quite as extreme, and then that gets passed down into my generation, where it begins to totally disappear as society changes, and you can see that progression through generation to generation. And I assume it's probably a similar sort of thing.
I think that's a good way of putting it, that cultural change takes time.
Mm-hmm.
And religion is, of course, a part of culture. So
absolutely. I was just checking my notes to make sure that I get all my questions in that I wanted to before we do run out of time. I guess one, I don't know if this will be a quick or long answer. Is there a huge difference between the conversion of Iceland and that of mainland Scandinavia, as in Norway, Sweden, Denmark?
Yeah. I think there is for the simple reason that Icelandic society really was different in the conversion period, in that I mean, it's smaller for starters. And as you know, famously, Iceland doesn't have a king until the 13th century, when they accept or are forced to accept the king of Norway as their sovereign. So, because of that, it worked differently. I mean, the usual story. I'm sure you know it. There is this famous story of. There are missionaries coming to Iceland. There are some Icelanders converting to Christianity, and then there are problems because not everybody are following the same law, is what the texts say. Then they have this meeting, the famous Althing, the kind of proto-parliament of Iceland, in the year, exactly the year 1000, or as a scholar figured it out 30, 40 years ago, it was actually 999, but year 1000 is easiest to remember. Well, whatever. But they had this big meeting with everybody where they decided, okay, now we're all going to become Christian, but we are going to keep these three practices. It's about practices. Those are going to continue to be allowed. And one of them is that you can continue to sacrifice if you do it in private. Sacrifice to the pagan gods if you do it in private.
Okay.
But everybody has to become baptized. So again, I mean, notice how his focus is on what you do, not on what you think. The decision is not everybody has to believe in God, the Christian God. It's everybody has to become baptized. I mean, this is the story. It's a story.
Yeah,
it's an after construction of what happened.
It's almost as if a lot of it is on appearance and on almost like a box ticking exercise, as in outwardly they can say we've all been baptized. So it shows to, I guess, the Christian church, look, we've done what we should do, but in the day-to-day life, it's kind of, you can carry on doing what you want as long as you're not upsetting the status quo too much.
Yeah. You might think of it that it's about community. It's okay. About keeping the community together. Okay, we are all baptized, so we are the same, and we have that link together. Okay, if you want to sacrifice over there, do it in private, and then it doesn't influence the community. Then it's not like a lot of people coming together in a public place doing it.
Mm-hmm.
This is probably the main reason, or one of the main reasons, why various Scandinavian kings and rulers, and in this case the meeting of all the free and powerful men of Iceland, why they want to outlaw the public displays of paganism. Because that could become an alternative community, a community that's not loyal to me as the king, or to the idea of community in Iceland.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Again, I'm trying to quick fire through all my questions I had said before. This one I took from the talk that you did in Kansas that we kind of touched on at the start of the show, and I did want to get this in for the listeners, and that was this idea of how Charlemagne massacred, what was it, 4,500 Saxons at the massacre of Verdun, but he's hailed. He's, I think you said, he's the, is he the, not the king of Europe? What was it that he's known as?
These days, he's held up by the European community, European Union, as a kind of, our ancestor who first unified Europe.
Yeah, and then obviously we have the Vikings who have this image of, hyper violent,
Yes.
raping, pillaging, just pretty much an image that's stuck with them. If you ask anybody, particularly people who aren't interested in this world, just an everyday person on the street, what's the image of a Viking? They're gonna probably go with the dirty image that you kind of got rid of in the same talk, but they're going to go with that raping, pillaging, violent, almost animalistic, I guess, in their actions. And what do you think the reason is for that? Why Charlemagne kind of gets away with it with a very clean schoolboy image?
It's about marketing, isn't it? Charlemagne had his own history writers, and it's in fact they who say that he killed 4,500 in a single day, and they're probably exaggerating. But they killed a lot. The history of the Vikings is written by their victims, or the. If you think of the communities that they attacked, it's attacked by those who survived among that victim community. So that's why you hear all these really bad things about Vikings. And that's what I thought was very exciting when I was writing my books on this. I've written one book on the conversion and one more general book on Vikings, is to try to listen to the Vikings' own voices, and to use the actual sources that do survive from inside the Viking community from that time. And that is, I mean, that's runestones like the one I mentioned that Eivind had raised a little while ago. And there's also some poetry that survives from that time. And if you read those sources, you sort of get an image of successful Viking chieftains that is similar to the image of Charlemagne that Charlemagne's history writers and or marketers, the image they put up of him.
I wonder if the Vikings just needed a better marketing team there, then.
Yes, I mean Scandinavia was not a highly literate society, which was really their problem. There wasn't a tradition of writing long history works or such that was done under Charlemagne.
But
You
also, sorry to interrupt.
no, go ahead.
I was going to say also, it's when you really think about it, it's also kind of the opposite, because the Vikings having this bloodthirsty badass image has kind of put them into immortality, where probably almost anywhere you go on the earth, you mentioned the Vikings, they're gonna know, they have this image, they're gonna know of the Viking age, or something, somewhat. There's endless businesses named after the Vikings, whereas I would say not that many people will have heard of Charlemagne, particularly outside of history buffs. Most people probably wouldn't know who he is. So who had the last laugh, really, when it came to the marketing department?
You might wonder. It's very funny with as you say, you were alluding to trademarks. And there are many people who put Vikings into their trademarks, which I think I might have made a little fun of in that
You
Kansas
did.
City talk. But I mean,
Yeah.
when I talk, I usually show my students a PowerPoint slide where there is this Viking river cruises. It's like, look here, you can go on a river cruise like a Viking. I wonder if the plundering and raping is included in the price or not. And it's like, it's a very different kind of Yeah, sailing on rivers, obviously.
Yeah, I think what the reason why a lot of people would choose Viking in the business name is it kind of it's synonymized. I don't know if that's the right word. It's synonymous with an image of strength, and maybe reliability of something being quite sturdy. I think is the idea behind it is that if something's called Viking, it's going to be tough. It's going to be a well-made product. I think that's probably what this image is portraying.
Yeah, and no, I think you're right. And it, I mean, associate to, you know, Scandinavian cleanliness or fresh air and being strong and able of body and stuff like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, one of my other questions, which I was particularly interested in, and that was, do we ever see any of the other two Abrahamic faiths having any sort of impact on Scandinavia at all? Because obviously, the Vikings had some influence with Islam, I guess, in Spain and Seville, that kind of area.
Yeah.
Did we ever see any Scandinavians convert into Islam or Judaism? Is there any mention of that?
There are no sources to that,
okay.
No. But they certainly were in contact and knew of each other in Spain, as you said, but also in Eastern Europe, where, you know, I mean, there is the famous story of this Arab member of a diplomatic legation that goes to this community, the Bulgar community on the river Volga. I mean, this is some distance east of Moscow, which was a great trading town to which Scandinavians made it. And he Ibn Fadlan, the Arab who comes from Baghdad, it took him a year to get all the way up here. I mean, he's going there because this community, this tribe is converting to Islam. And there are still Muslims in this part of Russia today. And, you know, in historical time, there's been even more. But Scandinavians were in contact with them. They traded with them. They must have exchanged ideas and so forth also. We don't know of anybody who would have converted to Islam. There are no real traces of that. But what we do know is that, you know, that for the centuries, at the end of the first millennium, the 9th and the 10th century, the largest cache of Arab coins, silver coins, in the world is in Scandinavia.
Okay, yeah.
There are more dirham, is the technical term for Arabic silver coin. There are more dirhams in Sweden than in, you know, anywhere within the Arab Empire of that time.
Wow. Okay. So that shows a clear trade, some sort of trade link.
Trade link. And it also emphasizes that what I was talking about earlier, that it's so important for the Scandinavian chieftains and big people, important people, to have access to precious metals.
So kind of piggybacking on the last question, do we ever see it also going the other way with Christianity, as in, do we ever see Christians converting to paganism? Do they ever come to the border and look at the Scandinavians and go, oh, that's actually quite a cool way to live, I'm gonna try that out? does that ever happen?
I mean, there are a few famous cases from the early Middle Ages of things like that happening, apparently. But then you also have the many stories about backsliders, people who first convert and then sort of convert back as Scandinavians doing it. I mean, all of this is really complicated for a historian because religion was a burning issue in the Middle Ages, as it is still today, and that means that you very quickly got stories told because people wanted to tell stories in that way. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean there are plenty of people in Scandinavia, especially kings or chieftains, who are accused of, well, you converted to Christianity and now you're pagan again. That's so yeah. bad of you.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like heathenism is on the rise at the minute. It seems like there are so many people who are now beginning to believe in some form of paganism. I wouldn't Indeed. Be surprised if it was one of the quickest growing religions there is. I guess there isn't so much as a single religion. There's a whole bunch of different ones.
Yeah, there are different ones, but yes, it's quite large. Yeah, but again, my expertise is at least 500 years old. So
yeah. Oh, the one thing I wanted to ask, and this comes from the video that you had with Jackson Crawford.
All and right, yeah. It's a film just behind me here.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
And he mentions in that this idea of, and I think it's his idea, I'm not going to put it onto you, about Havamal being a Christian-based text. I wanted to expand further on it if you could remember. I can't remember the exact where I think it was, how it was, maybe it was put together with all the idea of the Havamal, as in you know, these things to follow, having a set rules to follow in life and that kind of thing, of how that was more of maybe a Christian idea. Am I right in that?
I mean, yes, absolutely. I remember it now. We were talking about both Havamal and Völuspá. Mm-hmm. I think Jackson spoke more about Havamal. I spoke more about Völuspá. Yeah. Yes, was our interest. But I mean, this, I think, illustrates what I was saying before about this long, slow burning process of Christianization, where it's very clear that in these supposedly very old poems, old pagan poems from Scandinavia, you do have motifs that look awfully Christian.
Mm-hmm.
And that goes for both Völuspá and Havamal. But then we should also remember that the reason we know of them is that they were written down in the 13th century in Iceland. And at that point, Iceland had been Christian for centuries, at least a couple of centuries. Mm-hmm. So there's some time in the process of transmission, these Christian motifs got attached or got into these poems. If you want to be really radical, you can say, oh, they were inserted when they were written down by a monk or whatever. But I mean, you don't need to go that far. You can say that, like, if I'm a pagan poet writing a poem in, say, the year 800, and I'm really pagan and I never met a Christian in my life, you have gotten enough ideas from Christianity already that you have absorbed some of them as, oh, that's not a bad idea.
Mm-hmm.
Thus, these ideas could creep into, I mean, they do creep into your cultural expressions.
Mm-hmm.
Just like, I mean, you can see it in archaeology that Christianity decided at an early point in its existence that it didn't want dead people to be burned.
Mm-hmm.
Scandinavians used to burn dead people, but then you have sort of waves of fashion that suddenly it's unfashionable to cremate. dead people in Scandinavia. And that doesn't mean that they become Christian suddenly, okay, but it means they got an influence by this thing, which, by the way, it wasn't the Christians who invented it anyway. They got it from what suddenly became fashionable in the Roman Empire in like the second century or something.
Things don't change, do they? It's so fascinating having these conversations and just seeing human traits in peoples from 1,000 years ago.
Yes.
To
indeed.
The same thing we see today. You know, we have, it happens a lot quicker now because we're a globalized society, but we have trends that come around and everybody jumps on the back of a trend for a little while and then a new one comes along. People being people. Okay, I guess the last thing is that I wanted to get your quick opinion on this, because I frequent, probably wrongly, I probably shouldn't do, a lot of Facebook groups that are interested in Vikings. They're filled with a lot of people who just have a very rudimentary entry, basic level knowledge base on this whole kind of sphere, I guess is would be the word I'd use. Now, the idea in a lot of these groups is that Christianity is this big bad boogeyman who just is something to be absolutely hated when it comes to the Viking Age, that they stole away this amazing pagan belief and just crushed it and kind of trod it all down and made everybody be Christian. And there's a real hatred in a lot of these groups and a lot of the people who kind of have an interest in this stuff for Christianity. And I've always been of the opinion that, you know, you kind of can't have the Viking Age without Christianity. It's all a mesh together. You can't separate the two. But I find it fascinating, this absolute hatred that so many people do have for it. And yeah, I didn't know.
Yeah.
I wonder if, not necessarily how accurate, because I guess we've covered that in the last hour of how it's not, there was a lot of benefits, I guess, to the conversion. But I guess I was hoping that you could maybe set the record straight in a sense of that it wasn't all some, you know, the big bad Christianity just coming along and doing their thing, I guess.
I think one thing one should remember is that the conversion was to a large extent voluntary in Scandinavia, unlike in other places in Europe. But it's interesting that it's actually, there are medieval Christian texts are the ones that hold up what the Vikings were and what their own Christian communities were as a kind of clash of civilizations almost. That is the perspective that you will find in, if you read 12th century English history writers and such. They hold up this enormous contrast between the pagan Vikings and the good Christians that they attacked. But they are missing the point that there was certainly never in the Middle Ages any really pure categories in the way that medieval writers were sometimes want to imagine.
Perfect. Let's wrap this up and then we can let the patrons ask you some questions. And I also want to ask you about the Minnesota Runestone. So we can I'm going to save that
Kensington,
for the I'm going to save that for the Q&A. So if you want to hear the answer to that, then jump over to our Patreon and you can get the bonus episode on there. But Anders, thank you very much. Do you want to let
thank
people
you for
know
having me.
Do you want to let people know the names of your books so they can grab a copy or whatever you're working on, so people can follow you?
Well, the subject on this is the conversion of Scandinavia.
Yeah.
And then I follow that up with more of a general book, The Age of the Vikings, which is used a lot as a course book in colleges that are teaching Viking history.
Perfect. I'm gonna hunt both of those down to stock on my website.
Thank you. Yeah.
Do you know who published them?
I mean, the conversion is Yale University Press, and this is Princeton. Age of the Vikings is Princeton University Press.
Because that's always one of my troubles whenever I go look to stock a book on the website, I have to like find who prints it and then hunt them down to find out stock it. So knowing the publisher is always easier.
Yes.
Wonderful.
Yeah, no, that's right.
If you would like to obviously follow the podcast, it's just at Nordic Mythology Podcast on all the different channels. Again, for people listening, if you enjoy the show, please leave us a 5-star rating and a positive review. But let's jump over and do the Q&A.